Oferecimento Esportes da Sorte. É muito mais que bet. Saques diários ilimitados e depósitos a partir de R$1. Quem experimenta não esquece. Jogue com responsabilidade.
Muito boa noite, bem-vindos. É uma viagem que ninguém deveria ser obrigado a fazer, menos ainda uma criança sozinha. É um pesadelo movido a um sonho, uma fuga cheia de coragem, um desencanto movido à fé, uma jornada de sofrimento, morte e solidão. Nosso convidado hoje é um poeta que aos 9 anos de idade deixou El Salvador para seguir o rastro dos pais e encontrá-los na terra prometida, nos Estados Unidos. Mais do que escapar, o desejo dele era a reunião da família. Solo, lonely, sozinho, solito. Ao longo de quase 5 mil quilômetros, o menino enfrentou ameaças externas e medos internos, naturalmente. Aprendeu palavras que jamais o abandonariam. Viagem, coiote, imigrante. Foram 2 meses até chegar aos braços dos pais, que não via há anos, e então retomar a vida. Décadas se passaram até que sua história, um trauma de muitas camadas que só pela poesia pôde ser superado e a história pôde ser contada. Solito é um belo livro de memórias, escrito em inglês e lançado no ano passado, com grande repercussão e enorme sucesso nos Estados Unidos. Até hoje figura em várias listas de melhores títulos de não ficção. E nele, nesse livro, fica claro, claritito. Imigrantes não são só sofrimento, são felicidade. É o que afirma seu autor, Javier Zamora.
Thank you.
Javier, your mother tongue is Spanish, but for most of your life now, your main means of expression is English. So what are the main differences between your persona when you speak Spanish and when you speak English? Because we have different personas for each language that we use. Don't you agree there?
That is interesting. And I guess my persona when I'm speaking Spanish is more, it's closer to home. And I guess I feel closer to my family, home, not the country, but my family. And with English, I get a sense that I am closer to my friends and the people that I've met in this country, if that makes sense.
It does, it does. But when you wrote it in English, or you first wrote it in Spanish and then you translated to English? No, you wrote straightforward in English.
Yep. I started writing the book at 29. I started writing my previous book in poetry when I was 17. And at 17, I had this fear, I think that a lot of immigrants fear, is that am I from El Salvador? Because I've spent 9 years over there. I'm about to turn 18 in the United States and I've spoken English for 8 to 9 years. So what am I? And I like to say that when I first started writing poetry, it was 50-50. Like poetry came out in Spanish and it came out in English. And sadly, the longer I've stayed in this country, it mostly comes out in English now. And so by 29, I was rarely starting to write in Spanish. So it all came out in English because now I'm 33, English is the easier language for me to speak because I have gone to school mostly in English. And I live in a country that mostly speaks English.
And speaking about languages, we are looking forward to see Solito translated in Portuguese. We have because this is a resolute campaign today, tonight, we have to have a translation of Solito for the Brazilian audience.
We do.
Solito would be called in Brazilian Portuguese, sozinho.
Sozinho.
Solito.
I like that.
Sozinho. You begin the book describing life in La Herradura, mm-hmm. your hometown in El Salvador. What do you recall when you think of your childhood in El Salvador?
nature. You know, I grew up in rural El Salvador, close to the coast. We call it an estero, so it's like a mangrove forest. And my neighbor had an anteater. There were, you know, coral snakes in the backyard, araucaries, toucans, beautiful motmots, different types of birds. So my world was filled with beauty. And I grew up poor, and so we didn't have a color TV. I didn't have a color TV until I was six. And so for me, color was in the green, in the mango trees, in the orange trees, in the banana trees, in the corn that we grew, in the beans. And so that is what I missed most once I got to the United States, because the United States, we were also poor and we didn't have access to nature. You know, it was mostly apartment buildings, and it was cold, and I wasn't close to a warm ocean. You know, the farther north or south you go, the colder the water is, and I just missed it all.
You describe a dreamlike scenario of your childhood, and it's ironic to think that El Salvador was at war during that time.
Well, yes and no. The war stopped, they stopped in 92. Yeah, so I was 2 years old when the war stopped. And then people began, and I talk about this in the book, in 1997, when I was 7 years old, people began to be murdered again. But as a kid, I like to say that I was very fortunate to perhaps have been born and have my childhood in the few years of peace that my country had. So it's a childhood that sadly those born after me didn't get to enjoy, and those born before me also didn't get to enjoy.
Listen, Javier, your dad fleeing from war and looking for opportunities, your dad went away, then your mom went away. And how did you as a kid understand they had to leave? What did they tell you?
My dad, I don't remember when he left. I was a few months old. I was about to turn one. And so I don't know. What my mom told me is that he had to leave because he has had to. There was no reason. When my mom left, she explained to me that she was leaving for a trip, but she was gonna come back soon. I was 5 years old when she left. So I didn't really understand that they were gonna take so long until I saw my mom again. I genuinely thought that I was gonna see her for Christmas or when I turned six. And then once I turned six, she explained that she was gonna return when I was seven. When I turned seven and people began to get shot, they explained that now I needed to go and be with them into this country that by then we had a color TV, we had a VHS, I was watching Titanic, I was watching Baywatch, Full House, Friends. So to me, this country was beautiful, it was rich, it was safe, and it was a country that I really wanted to go to because I wanted to swim in the Baywatch beach. You know, I wanted to go to Malibu. And I thought that my parents lived in Malibu, but they did not live in Malibu.
How did you call America then? Is Lausa?
Lausa.
Lausa. Mm-hmm. Well, I want to show the little Javier, when you were seven. I want to show to our audience. We found this in your social media. Let's have a look at that. Seems like a very comfortable and happy boy. Who's that with you, Javier?
That's my Aunt Molly.
Your aunt.
Yeah.
Incredible. Very good dancer. And who's the little one?
That's my cousin Julia.
Julia.
And that's my grandma. Then,
and now the lady? Your
my grandma.
Javier, are you still a good dancer?
I still dance like that, sadly.
You still dance like that. So it doesn't show longing or anxiety. 2 years later, you started to to plan your trip 2 years after that. Mm-hmm. When did you learn this word, viajen, trip? When did you learn that you were about to do the same trip as your parents did?
I like this interview because that is around the time when I learned that. And I've never seen myself in an interview. So thank you for that. Because that was my 7th birthday party. And I don't know if it was before or after where my mom's friend got shot right in front of our house. And around that time, it quickly changed the calls where like, oh, you're gonna go on this trip to come be with us.
Javier, your book is a harsh coming of age story. Some would say it's a romance de formación. It's a heavy journey faced by a child. And usually this kind of story focuses on internal dialogues and thoughts. But your writing is much more about describing what you see with a voice that brings back with a 9-year-old boy voice. Was this planned or was it the only way you could do it?
I didn't plan to do it like that way. I actually started writing the book from my 29-year-old self remembering the past. And I got bored with that version of the book. So if I was bored, that's a problem because the readers would also be bored. And at around the same time, I started going to therapy. And my therapist suggested what would happen if I wrote, because I told her that I was a writer, what would happen if I wrote from the point of view of the 9-year-old kid. And so I listened and I wrote. The first time that I wrote like that way was when I'm on the boat. So the whole boat scene was the first instance when I'm telling the story as a 9-year-old kid. And then I compare those passages with what I had before, and I liked them. They were moving faster. I could read them. The other things felt forced. And as I kept on going to therapy, I realized that kid, meaning me, survived this trauma by looking at nature. Because my childhood, before TV, all I had was nature, and I would like go outside. If I wanted an orange, I can like climb the orange tree and get an orange. If I want a mango, I can climb a mango tree and get it. So my world of nature became my coping mechanism that kept me from the darkness of the trauma.
When you say nature, you're actually meaning beauty.
Absolutely.
Beauty as a lifesaver. Yeah, mm-hmm. Yeah. Some of the most beautiful passages of your book is when you describe your moments of joy and companionship with Los Cés. It's after your grandpa had to leave you with the coyote and the group. How do you still have this moment with you up to now, up to today?
You know, Los Cés, or the Six, were the people, all Salvadorans, we all met day one when I left my hometown, April 6th of 1999. We met in the capital, we took a bus, and we went to Guatemala. And slowly, one of them was named Chele, he was 35 years old. Another man was around 30, his name was Marcelo. A 30-year-old mom named Patricia, her 12-year-old daughter, Carla, and a 20-year-old young man named Chino, and myself. So we are the Six. And the coyote leaves us in Guatemala, which is something that all of us didn't account for. And then for the next 7 weeks, we have to find new coyotes, and we all help each other survive. And for 20 years, I didn't want to remember them. I knew they existed, but in the back of my brain only. You know, I didn't allow them to come forward because if I did, I would break down. And so again, it took starting this book and going to therapy. It took those acts in order for me to remember them and embody them and almost try to thank them, because I wouldn't be here without them.
And the way you mentioned the importance that your therapy had in this process, I wonder if, as a writer, when you start your process of recollections, it's amazing. It seems like you remember a lot very vividly. You describe very detailed situations. How did you light up your memory?
I think when you go through trauma, every brain processes it differently. For me, and I think it had a lot to do with growing up in rural El Salvador, my brain chose to remember the hardest parts. So those things I always carried with me. I will carry them with me for the rest of my life. You know, the smell of the dirt in Oaxaca when we're facing down and cops are pointing guns at us. I can still smell that. What was hard is that once you no longer are in a life and death situation, meaning my life in the United States, those details will come out when I didn't expect them or when I didn't want them to. For example, if I was watching a movie and it was about immigration, it would re-traumatize me. And then that smell, that memory, everything was like I was there again. And so finally, I think when I was 17, I started to write some of those things down. And then when I was 29, when I started Solito, it was easy to go back there and be in that scene. That's one part of it. Another part of it, I had to move to the desert. I live in Tucson now, in Arizona, where I crossed. I moved here in order to live and expose myself to where I crossed. So I couldn't, I think half of the book
is- The same desert that you crossed.
The same desert. So half of the book is not in the desert, and I had written that much, and then I couldn't write the rest of it because I needed to be there. And so the second half of the book wouldn't have been able to write it unless I moved here. And I still live here.
Listen, Javier, it seems people don't really acknowledge that many children do this migration route almost routinely. And they travel with their families or unaccompanied like you did. So we selected an excerpt from a TV report of a very brilliant Brazilian reporter. He has a show called Profissão Repórter. It's Caco Barcelos. We'll watch it together, if you don't mind.
Nós, migrantes, não somos criminales.
Também estamos pedindo respeito aos direitos humanos.
A manifestação do México reúne quem foge da miséria e da violência, como esse menino de El Salvador, Luiz, de 11 anos. Luiz tem uma página na internet.
Essa provavelmente seja a mãe do Luiz. O Luiz nos disse que ela vive nos Estados Unidos, mas aqui no Facebook ela aparece como enfermeira que mora na Guatemala.
Agora pela manhã, muitas famílias chegaram com filhos, né? Mães com seus filhos. Aqui ao lado são vários. As mães recebem um apoio de carros como esse. A carroceria está cheia de criança.
This was 2017. Children have always been there, taking your path. But the world seems to have started paying more attention to it during the Trump administration. Why would that, how do you explain that?
I think it's reactionary. You know, if you look at figures, still before 2017, the most immigrants came during the 90s, but nobody was talking about us then. And then we had a peak in 2014. There was a brief mention, and then Trump gets elected in 2016, where actually there was a slight drop of people coming here. People began to immigrate more and more. And now in 2023 is actually the year with the most immigrants, even more than when people were covering it. I make sense of it by, you know, in this country, in the United States, people think that a Democratic president is good. And because we assume that they're good, that they're taking care of immigrants. And we assume that only conservatives, Republicans, are the bad ones, which I like to say that they're both bad. You know, Trump deported so many people, but actually Biden has deported a lot more people than Trump. But now it's like, Trump is not, or Biden is not saying the things out loud. He's not being openly racist, so he must be okay, you know? And so I think that is the problem, not only in American politics, but all over Latin America, certainly in my country as well. You know, if you know how to speak, people believe it. Yeah. But then you always have to look at the facts.
That's right. Javier, how do you feel about the word immigrant?
Creo que en este milenio hay que recuperar esa palabra de donde está actualmente. Yo crecí en los Estados Unidos y cuando escuchaba esa palabra, I guess I'm speaking in Spanish now. I grew up in the United States, you know. I think it is time to take that word back. Because it's been so negative, especially in the United States. And I truly believe that in the 21st century, this is gonna be a word that we immigrants and people have to take back and actually acknowledge that it's a powerful word. Being an immigrant means that you're a transgressor and that you are a radical. Because you, by the sheer act of movement, you are saying that you do not believe in borders and that you do not believe in countries, but you do believe in the freedom of movement. And I think that is where the word needs to go in this century. So people stop viewing immigrants as something negative, as something that is taking away. But I would like to argue that being an immigrant is giving. We know more worlds, more worldviews than somebody who has never traveled or has never left their home. You know, we know what that is like. And because we know what that's like, we are better for it. And we have a weird superpower that we can use and that we contribute. And yeah, I don't know.
Antes de ir para o intervalo, eu vou ler alguns versos do poeta e músico uruguaio Jorge Drexler. E depois, no intervalo, a gente vai poder ouvir o próprio Javier Zamora lendo um trecho muito lindo de seu livro Solito. Atravessamos desiertos, glaciares, continentes. El mundo entero de extremo a extremo, empecinados, supervivientes. Somos una especie en viaje. No tenemos pertenencias, sino equipaje. Vamos con el polen en el viento. Estamos vivos porque estamos en movimiento. Somos padres, hijos, nietos y bisnietos de inmigrantes. Yo no soy de aquí, pero tú tampoco. De ningún lado del todo, de todos lados un poco. So, Javier, would you please read an excerpt of Solito to us, maybe in Spanish, so we can hear how you sound en castellano también?
Eso. Okay. I'm going to read. Al final del capítulo uno, cuando me voy. Este es 6 de abril 1999. Está de madrugada, una madrugada color índigo, como cuando mi mamá se fue. Tía Mali me despierta a besos y sé que me tengo que alistar ya. Los gallos cantan, la bonita ladra, los pájaros silban, el mundo está despertándose. Una por una se apagan las estrellas en el cielo. Para bañarme, saco agua del pozo con una cubeta. El abuelo ya se bañó. Abuelita Nelly me ayuda a secarme. Tía Mali plancha mi ropa. Escogimos la ropa con cuidado. Una bonita camisa de vestir azul oscuro, unos blue jeans del mismo color, un cincho negro y unos zapatos negros de vestir. A la par de los huevos duros, del aguacate, del queso duro y las tortillas, está una mochila negra con la marca tachada. Adentro de la mochila hay una camiseta negra, unos pantalones negros, dos calzoncillos, un par extra de zapatos, un cepillo de dientes, un peine, unos chores de fútbol, una pasta de dientes Colgate, una barra de jabón Palmolive, un bote de champú Head and Shoulders y otra camisa de vestir de mangas cortas color azul oscuro. Dentro también está mi cuaderno, lapiceros Bic, unos lápices y las tareas que me dieron mis maestros. Todo tiene que ser oscuro, dice tía Mali. Así nos dijo el coyote. Mientras desayuno, el abuelo me espera en la puerta. Él tenía mi mochila negra y otra suya. Mira qué horas son en su reloj. Abuelita Nelly me peina el pelo. Tía Mali se arrodilla frente a mí, me abotona la camisa. La mete dentro de mis blue jeans, me besa la frente. Lupe está en la casa. Nunca había llegado tan temprano. Ella me abraza, me llena de besos y me dice que tenga suerte. Julia está dormida en la cama de abuelita Nelly, entre dos almohadas para evitar que se caiga al suelo. Abuelita Nelly me da más besos y se arrodilla a abrazarme. Después, tía Mali y abuelita Nelly me abrazan al mismo tiempo. Hasta ahí es cuando lloro. Hoy sí, llegó la hora, la cosa que quería que pasara. Pero está pasando tan rápido. Te queremos mucho, Chepito. Te cuidas. Que Dios te bendiga aquí, donde sea que estés y siempre. Vamos a estar esperándote. Vamos a pedirle a Dios para que llegues bien allá, Javiercito. Sus voces casi en unísono, suaves, quebrándose más con cada palabra. Lágrimas ruedan por sus caras redondas. Yo no puedo dejar de llorar. Luego me dibujan una cruz en la frente, en la cabeza, en todo mi cuerpo. Con sus manos me secan las lágrimas. El abuelo me toma del brazo, me guía a través de la puerta. No mires atrás, dice. Pero igual, miro. Veo a abuelita Nelly y tía Mal en medio de la puerta, abrazadas, y Lupe tiene los hombros de ellas en sus manos. Vamos, dice el abuelo. Y caminamos, él y yo.
Beautiful, Javier.
Yes.
It's harder to ignore a kid, as you say. Muito obrigado, Javier.
Thank you.
Mais uma vez, a gente recomenda a leitura de Solito para quem lê em espanhol ou em inglês, já é possível comprar. E espera uma atitude das editoras do Brasil para que traduzam e lancem Solito em português aqui para o leitor brasileiro. Até a próxima. Quer ver mais? Entre no Globoplay.